Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin our reading of this week's Triangle Business Journal at the biz page, as usual. Under the heading of New Approach comes the article, Drones Make an Impact as North Carolina Responds to Hurricane. Following Superstorm Hurricane Florence, the NC Department of Transportation did something it had never done before. It deployed drones to monitor and document flooding, road conditions, and traffic impacts. And it appears some were noticing. NCDOT was just handed a regional award in the 2019 America's Transportation Awards competition from the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials in the Best Use of Technology and Innovation Small Project category. In the storm's aftermath, more than a dozen NCDOT teams flew more than 200 missions, capturing 8,000 photos and videos of the destruction Florence left behind. That helps state and federal agencies make real-time response decisions. NCDOT Aviation Director Bobby Walston credited incredible teamwork and ingenuity with the project's success and adds that it will serve as a blueprint for future disaster response efforts. And under the heading of New Leaders comes the article, UNC fills two key positions as fall semester looms. Look for a couple of new faces in leadership positions in Chapel Hill next month as the University of North Carolina heads into the fall semester. Charles Marshall, a partner in the Raleigh office of the Brooks Pierce Law Firm, will take over as the new Vice Chancellor and General Counsel September 16th. He replaces Mark Merritt, who left the university at the end of 2018 to return to a Charlotte law firm. Marshall has undergraduate and law degrees from UNC. At Brooks Pierce, he has been involved in issues including civil litigation, regulatory enforcement, and governmental affairs, as well as data privacy and media issues. Meanwhile, UNC also has a new police chief in David Perry, who has been serving at Florida State University. He begins September the 3rd and replaces Jeff McCracken, who retired in July after 30 years. McCracken came under public scrutiny during the Silent Sam Confederate Monument protests. And under the heading of Iconic NC Barbecue Location Has a Buyer, and now what? One of North Carolina's best-known barbecue locations is about to be sold. Bill Ellis opened Bill's Barbecue in 1963 and turned it into a sprawling operation with trucks that spread out across the region and beyond to deliver his Eastern North Carolina-style barbecue. But Ellis died in 2017, and his family closed the restaurant in January. Wilson agent Chuck Williamson listed the property, which includes five buildings and more than 47,000 square feet, for $2.5 million. That includes a 14,000-square-foot convention center that can hold 1,000 people. Williamson tells Biz the property will close in October. An investor bought it. He's got big plans for it, Williamson says. It's going to be great for the area. That's really a hot location. One recent Saturday, for example, a Sheetz was packed with people while across the street, the Bills complex was silent. Williamson says the investor is from Wilson, but he doesn't know if reviving the barbecue restaurant is in his plans. And under the heading of Great Guests comes the article, Founder Delivers at Wake Forest Franchise. The man who founded a burger chain in Wisconsin in 1984 was in the Triangle recently to deliver orders and greet customers. Craig Culver, who founded the company with his wife Leah and CEO Joe Koss, visited the Culver's restaurants in Wake Forest, owned by Barb and Eric Neudecker, who also owns the Culver's in Clayton. The eatery also is opening at a new location in Apex. Culver and Koss delivered orders to customers and spoke with employees about the early days in the business and how their small Midwest town's values helped shape the hospitality at all Culver's locations. Our Wake Forest restaurant marked the first Culver's in the Triangle and only the third in the state, says Barb Neudecker. We opened the Clayton location this past June. And under the heading of Cool Event comes the article, Museum Gets Lift from Beer Drinking Crowd. With all proceeds going to the Friends of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, the annual Natural Selections beer event took place in the evening hours of the museum on August 16th. More than 1,000 people came to celebrate over beer, cider, and mead, as more than 20 local breweries contributed. On hand were some popular breweries such as Bond Brothers, Raleigh Brewing Company, Pony Saurus, Deep River Brewing, and New Belgium Brewing, which was pouring samples of its latest NC State University collaboration beer, Old Tuffy. Patrons also treated themselves to educational stations where one can learn about the science of beer, including the different types of hops and malts. Guests could also text their choice for the best beer of the evening. The winner was Cary's Cotton House Craft Brewers with its Mesopotamia Ale. And finally, on this week's biz page, under the heading of Adding Space, comes the article, North Hills Plans for More Hotel and Residential Units. North Hills is going vertical again, and this time on the original side of the development. Kane Realty Corporation has filed an administrative site plan review with the City of Raleigh to allow for the redevelopment, which would include an underground parking deck and a mixed-use building with a maximum height of 12 stories. Nearly 1 million square feet of additional space could be added. The area currently includes multiple buildings housing restaurants, such as a Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, an Ethan Allen Furniture Store, and other businesses. The site has over 773,000 square feet of space. The redevelopment would demolish 150,000 square feet of space and add over 959,000 square feet for a grand total of 1.58 million square feet of space. The plan also calls for 426 residential units and includes 229 hotel units. Now we turn the page to the Finance, EcoDevo, and Tech page. Under the heading of Economic Development comes the article, State's Top Commerce Exec Talks Growth. Expect more jobs and more investment in the Tar Heel State, at least if the state's top economic development recruiter has anything to say about it. We're going to have a busy rest of the year, says North Carolina Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland, shortly after Xerox announced 600 jobs in Cary. Copeland can't be specific, he says. His department has a policy against commenting on active projects, a policy he cited when asked about both Mahindra Automotive North America, whose officials have said they're considering North Carolina for an automobile plant, and Apple, which, despite picking Texas for a major project, has real estate in Research Triangle Park. But generally, he says, the team is seeing a lot of activity all over the state. And he says that, as a whole, they're most interested in one thing, North Carolina's workforce. He says it's critical that North Carolina continue to invest in its education system and infrastructure if it wants to keep attracting big job creation projects like Xerox. The greatest challenge globally is skilled workforce. And I'd say any life sciences or financial services company in the world that's looking to expand has to look at North Carolina just because of our workforce, Copeland says. And under the heading of litigation comes the article, Former Southern Season Execs Deny Wrongdoing During Tenure. 3 years after the bankruptcy petition, the court battle continues for the executives who used to own a Chapel Hill grocery store. In May, they were handed a lawsuit filed by investors looking for payback for what was lost when a Southern Season, the specialty foods giant, went bankrupt in 2016. Today, the Southern Season store in Chapel Hill is owned by Calvert Retail, which is not a party to the litigation. But the store used to be under the purview of Peter Reichard, Peter Coker, and Clay Hamner, all managing partners of investment firm Trian Capital, LLC. In a 17-page filing, The three men rejected claims made in May by investor Robert Bezell, who accused him of constructive fraud. At all times relevant, plaintiffs were qualified and sophisticated investors who conducted significant due diligence prior to making membership contributions to SSAC Capital. Their response reads, plaintiffs did not rely on any statements made by any of the defendants, but rather relied on their own assessments of the books and records of Southern Season to make the capital contributions. Defendants claimed that they acted in good faith. Bezell, along with co-plaintiff NPC Southern Season Investment LLC, filed suit in May against Reichert, Coker, and Hamner, accusing them of luring investments even when Southern Season was circling the drain. The lawsuit claims they used false statements and representations to induce hundreds of thousands of dollars in investment, an allegation flatly denied in the recent response. And under the heading of foreign trade comes the article, Execs Chime In on Saber-Rattling Surrounding Tariffs on Trade. The ongoing trade war with China is having an impact on top employers in the triangle. Here's what CEOs had to say about tariffs and the trade war on recent earnings calls. So the trade war, so it's not good for the entire society. It's not good for the entire management of the company. So we wish China and the U.S. can resolve this and reach an agreement as soon as quarter four. But even with the worst scenario, I think the Lenovo businesses are in a better position than our competition because we actually have a globally diverse manufacturing footprint with multiple manufacturing facilities around the world, said Yuan King Yang, CEO of Lenovo. And here from Tom Greco, CEO of Raleigh-based Advance Auto Parts. We've always been very successful in passing on price to the consumers. It's not something we want to do. We want to find alternative methods to keep the prices lower for our customers. We don't see any concerns around being able to pass that price on. And finally, from Chuck Robbins, Cisco CEO, his quote, "The overall Chinese market is certainly not a major play for us, but it has just dropped precipitously in light of the trade discussions." Now we turn the page to the healthcare and education page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Major Decisions comes the article, Health Systems Settle in Battle Over Wake County. A much-long legal battle over expanding operating rooms at healthcare providers in Wake County has reached a conclusion. Since October, UNC Healthcare, Duke University Health, and WakeMed Health and Hospitals have been fighting over competing applications for the distribution of six operating rooms in Wake County. In January, each system had its request denied by the state, leading to three individual lawsuits. Now, according to documents obtained through the NC Department of Health and Human Services, which regulates the expansion of healthcare services through the Certificate of Need process, the three health systems have agreed to a settlement, though none obtained the full scope of the ambitious expansions they had originally planned. The settlement allows for WakeMed to construct both of its ambulatory centers at a reduced scale, Duke to construct its center at a drastically reduced scope, and UNC to add two new operating rooms to UNC Rex Hospital. The agreement came largely from a mediated conference between the systems April 26th, according to state documents. And under the heading of Adding Cash comes the article, Eckert pulls in nearly $16 million for her Raleigh company. Just over a year after relaunching her old company, Cindy Eckert has brought in another $15.9 million from an army of investors to continue bolstering sale of its female Viagra. Eckert, the CEO of Sprout Pharmaceuticals, made waves by selling the company to Valeant Pharmaceuticals for $1 billion before suing the company over its development and commercialization of Addye, that's Addye, a drug approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to treat a female sexual disorder, and eventually selling the company back to shareholders for a 6% royalty on global sales. back under her purview, the company officially relaunched in June of 2018 and is, according to Eckert, seeing record-breaking sales month to month. Eckert declined to disclose exact revenue figures, but her investors seem to agree things are going well. According to a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the company raised $15.9 million out of a $20 million offering that began on August the 2nd. The round included 110 investors in total, with $4.1 million remaining to be sold. Eckert says she's confident the remaining sum will be rounded out in a couple of weeks, noting that the round was entirely from existing investors. "It's an affirmation of how things are going," she says. "It's just satisfying to have Adyee back under our ownership and see it be launched and women affordably get it and march it forward." The funding is earmarked purely for growth, she says, hoping to reinforce their marketing and sales of Adyee. "We have opportunities certainly in sales and marketing and opportunity in terms of expanding our team," she says. "We continue to grow and the proceeds will be used toward those endeavors." And in other articles from the healthcare and education page of this week's journal, come under the heading of medicine comes the article, GI Practice Gets Approval for Wake County Expansion. A fast-growing independent gastrointestinal practice has received approval for a new location in Wake County, one of several the practice hopes to launch in the Triangle in the coming years. Wake Endoscopy, a private practice that has been thriving in recent years through opening and acquiring more locations throughout the Triangle, received regulatory approval from the NC Department of Health and Human Services Certificate of Need Department. The approval of the request, first made in May, allows the practice to construct a new $2.3 million center in Cary. According to its application, the center will have three procedure rooms, as well as 16 employees by its second year in operation. According to the state medical facilities plan, there are currently 46 endoscopy rooms in Wake County, which serviced 84,077 procedures last year. The practice projects to serve 4,132 patients by 2021, 86% of which will come from Wake County. It projects an additional 5% of its patient base to be residents of Johnston County, with the rest coming from surrounding counties. Wake Endoscopy projects it will perform more than 4,800 procedures annually at the new practice by 2023. The $2.3 million necessary for construction will be financed entirely through loans, according to the filing. But the practice projects to recover costs quickly, estimating a net income of more than $3 million in the first three fiscal years of operation. Wake Endoscopy has averaged 10,000 procedures annually since 2013, reporting more than 13,000 procedures in 2018. The company anticipates as many as 16,000 procedures in 2019. Those procedures resulted in roughly $30 million in revenue last year, reportedly double of what they bought in just 5 years ago. And under the heading of payoff for going to school comes the article, Choose Your Major Wisely When Going to College. As thousands of new students arrived on campus for the first day of college in the past few days, data from the University of North Carolina system show the degree students pursue will have a lasting effect on their future salaries. According to data collected by NC officials, the NC Community College System and the UNC system, the salary difference between areas of study can vary by as much as $28,000 per year. For example, the median wage of graduates from the UNC system in nursing is reported as $60,115. Graduates of an associate's degree program in nursing at NC Community College reported a median wage of $55,377. The top-paying majors all fall under the science, technology, engineering, and math categories, with most high performance in the engineering fields. Looking at graduates of the system's 16 universities in the first 5 years after leaving school, computer engineering majors reported the highest salaries, with a median wage of $82,713. The highest paying associate degree program was reported as Fire Protection Technology at $57,575. Close behind came Electrical Engineering at $74,997 and Computer Science at $73,868. The top three were followed by chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, industrial technology, and registered nursing. And finally, on the healthcare and education page of this week's journal, under the heading of College Trends, comes the article, Report Shows Student Debt Has Tripled in Last Decade. In just the last 10 years in North Carolina, student loan debt has more than tripled, putting at risk not only students' post-graduation success, but the rigor of the state's economy. According to a white paper by the Durham-based Center for Responsible Lending, 1.2 million North Carolinians now report outstanding student loan debt. The total burden now reaches $44 billion. In 2008, that debt totaled just $15.4 billion. That's a 286% increase in the last decade. The report blames a long familiar list of challenges for higher education as the cause of the increase. Fueling the growth of student debt in North Carolina are big picture trends such as cuts in state funding and the attendant rapid rise in college tuition, growing college attendance, longer times to completion as working adults go back to school, and post-graduation incomes that are not keeping pace with rising costs, the report states. The report notes that debt is worse for minorities, females, and those of low economic status and rural origins. In fact, the Rural Metropolitan Statistical Area, that's an MSA, ranks the lowest for delinquency rate by MSA at just 13.3%. The Charlotte MSA rated at 15.6%. The report points to the trend as a troubling spot on North Carolina's horizon, which could see an economic decline because of its squeezed citizens. Next, we turn to this week's real estate page in the journal, and under the heading of Cargo Containers comes the article, RTP Dreams Big with Small Store Concept. Beginning this year, entrepreneurs and restaurateurs will have the chance to wrap their business ideas in cargo container steel in the heart of Research Triangle Park. Boxyard RTP is a mixed-use development soon to be built using shipping containers, with the goal of jump-starting some of the area's brightest ideas for hyper-local restaurants and retail. It will be the first stage of the Research Triangle Foundation of North Carolina's redevelopment of 100 acres in RTP. The project is scheduled to break ground August 27th. Boxyard RTP is a workhorse opportunity for RTP in the region, says Scott Levitin, president and CEO of the Research Triangle Foundation. Experimental food, libations, and retail, cool programming, and event opportunities will flip the energy switch for RTP and our neighborhood communities. The concept has been used in other cities, including Tucson, Arizona, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. Amanda Freistock, director of programs at the foundation, says Buckshot RTP will allow entrepreneurs and restaurateurs a place to explore new concepts, while giving residents and workers around the region a place to spend time in the heart of the park. Buckshot RTP will be the only restaurant and retail park in the Triangle built almost entirely out of reused 320-square-foot shipping containers. It really challenges these restaurateurs and entrepreneurs to bring their ideas into a small space and work through what it's like to have a restaurant concept in 960 feet, Freistock says. The development will feature 15 concepts, 10 for restaurants and 5 for retail. And when we say retail, we're not thinking like high heel shoes and things like that, Freistock says. It's more like services and experiences. It's not so much you're going to buy something. You're going to feel it out and experience it. And while not considered an incubator, the foundation is looking for hyperlocal tenants with new and innovative business concepts to lease the spaces. Store sizes range from 1 to 6 shipping containers. The first tenants will be announced at the groundbreaking. Maverick Partners will represent brokerage for Boxyard RTP. And under the heading of New Project comes the article, Apex Looking to Spark Investment in Corporate Center. The town of Apex is looking to attract more commercial investment. And through an agreement with a local landowner, the town has found the land it needs. Apex is marketing the 121-acre Cash Corporate Center to commercial and industrial companies looking for land that's ready to develop. The property at 2100 Production Drive southeast of town is zoned for light industrial use. Apex Economic Development Director Joanna Helms says when her department was created several years ago, the town began looking for opportunities to attract companies. To do this, they needed land. We spent some time researching and looking and came across this site, Helms said. It was right adjacent to an existing business park, and it was already zoned light industrial. We established a relationship with that property owner and started working with him. The town and the landowner ultimately drew up an agreement in which the town will handle the work necessary to certify the site for development. This meant paying for surveys, aerial photography, signage and engineering, and more to make sure the site is shovel-ready when sold. Cash Corporate Center is now listed at $55,000 an acre. Parcels have a 10-acre minimum and one business maximum per parcel. Once sold, the town will receive a proportional amount of the sale based on its investment in the land. Permitted uses for the site include office space, government facilities, lab and research space, breweries, a helipad, manufacturing, and much more. It's really hard to speculate how it will develop, Helms says. It could develop into 10-acre parcels, or we could get a life sciences company come in and build a life sciences campus. Now we come to the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled North Carolina Ports Scramble to Keep Pace. Now, this article also has a very big graphic here that ranks ports. And it informs us that the key measure in the shipping industry is 20-foot equivalent containers, or TEUs. And so this graph lists the TEUs for the volume in 2018 of six of the ports on the East Coast. Baltimore at a little at 1,023,000 TEUs. Norfolk, Virginia, with 2,856 TEUs. As we go down to South Carolina, Charleston has 2,316 TEUs. Sorry, that's 2,316,000. Savannah, Georgia, has 4,352,000. And then Jacksonville, Florida, southernmost, has 1,288,000 TEUs. And I've left Wilmington last because it had 322,000. And if you were listening closely, that's the smallest of these six ports. So I guess the ports are scrambling to keep pace. So here's the text of the article. Malcolm McLean hardly looked like someone destined to change the world as he waited by his truck at a New Jersey dock in 1937. He was born in the small North Carolina town of Maxton, an hour and a half from Wilmington, and never went to college. But he survived the Great Depression by hauling bales of cotton and other Tar Heel products to northern ports. One day, McLean watched the longshoremen grab items off trucks and load them into ships. Wouldn't it be great if my trailer could simply be lifted up and placed on the ship without its contents being touched, he thought. He never forgot that simple insight. Wealthy by 1956, he converted a World War II tanker into a ship that could carry containers. The shipping industry was transformed. Ever since, ports around the world have raced to service the rising size of ships with massive cranes and deeper ports. And yet the industry McLean forged left North Carolina in its wake. Production at the Wilmington and Morehead City ports is dwarfed by the ports in Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia. Savannah, Georgia, for example, processed 13 times the cargo that Wilmington did in 2018. Looking to turn this around, the North Carolina State Ports Authority hired Paul Koza as executive director in 2014. 5 years later, the port system has seen growth, both in cargo and in capacity, at what COSA has described as a rapid, rapid pace. But the state still trails its neighbors, and the gap has widened during that time. It's as if North Carolina's playing poker and finally has three jacks, but is constantly trumped by four queens. The scope of the difference raises important questions as the state peers ahead in the changing landscape of international trade and as lawmakers siphon tens of millions of dollars into the state's port system with the hope that new business is just around the corner. While North Carolina's port's top-line base has gone up from about $80 million in 2017 to $94 million last year, a 17.5% increase, so has its expenses from $43.8 million in 17 to $53.6 million in 2018, and that's a 22.4% increase. What makes the math somewhat more difficult is that Jones Street is pouring in an additional $10 million for the state's ports to succeed. But is the state investing enough, and should it invest more? Or can North Carolina ever really catch up? No one doubted the North Carolina Ports Authority had been neglected in recent decades. Hiring COSA was a measure of how the state wanted to change that. Before COSA, former Raleigh Mayor Tom Bradshaw led it for a year, leaving abruptly in January 2013 and earning a salary of $150,000. COSA is a 1984 graduate at the U.S. Military Academy who began his service as a helicopter pilot. Before coming to North Carolina, he was president of the CSL Group, a marine logistics company and the world's largest operator of self-unloading vessels. He had extensive executive experience with Maersk, a Danish multinational corporation that's the world's largest container shipping company. He's an industry blue blood, amongst the best of the best, says Walter Kimsey's, an economist and chief strategist at JLL, who focuses on ports and rail systems. Highly respected, highly regarded. The state was willing to pay for that expertise, with COSA earning a current salary of $275,000. He was not available to talk about the current situation and competition surrounding North Carolina ports. Repeatedly, TBJ was told over the past few months that COSA was busy. He entered, realizing the depth of the challenge the state faced. For too long, the ports have not been a focus at all levels of state government, he told TBJ in 2015. North Carolina's port in Wilmington is more shallow, 42 feet, than many, and is miles up the Cape Fear River from the Atlantic Ocean. Other ports are closer to the critical corridor of I-95. The key roadway is I-95, Kimsey says. Once you get on I-95, you can go all the way to Maine and all the way to Miami. Meanwhile, the port has lacked some of the infrastructure that other ports enjoy. The state has responded by putting more money into the ports. According to the Office of the State Auditor's October 2018 report, the state budgeted $45 million for the ports in fiscal 2018, up from $35 million the year before. The state auditor reported that the Port Authority had total operating revenue of $43.1 million in fiscal 2017 and $47.7 million in fiscal 2018. And the cost of salaries rose to $18.9 million from $17.7 million during that time frame due to increased headcount. Under COSA, the ports have embarked on a $200 million capital improvements plan. A significant investment has been adding three Neo Panamax cranes from a Chinese manufacturer. The cranes cost $33.8 million and weigh 1,553 tons each. Each looks like a gigantic erector set. People in Wilmington line docks to watch as the cranes, with Port of Wilmington painted in white on their huge blue steel arms, floated into their places at the port. The third one arrived in April. The Neo Panamax cranes will allow us to work the largest vessels that are calling on the East Coast, NC Port's Chief Operating Officer Brian Clark said on a video capturing their arrival. It increases our abilities, so we're able to operate more vessels at the same time, COSA said in the video. Indeed, the goal of the cranes is to give the port much more capacity as the size of ships continues to explode. The industry standard for ship size is 20-foot equivalents, or TEUs, so one 20-foot container is one TEU. In April, the Port of Wilmington had its first 12,000 TEU vessel. COSA, in a statement, called it a monumental milestone. This is proof of concept that we are big ship ready and capable of handling some of the largest container vessels calling East Coast ports today, he said. But in fact, the game is again changing, and North Carolina is once again scrambling to catch up. In 1956, McLean's first container ship had only 58 boxes, and the race to build bigger ships with more capacity has continued ever since. The more containers you can pack on a ship, the more efficiently you can transport goods and thus keep costs down. The race to handle bigger ships intensified in 2016 with the opening of the expanded Panama Canal, a project called Panamax. Before the new locks were built, the largest ship the canal could handle was only 5,000 TEUs, an unthinkable Goliath in the days of Teddy Roosevelt, but a relatively average ship by modern standards. With the expansion, the canal can hold ships up to more than 14,000 TEUs. North Carolina's new Neo-Panamax cranes give it more ability to handle the big ships, but the state still faces constraints. The port's depth is only 42 feet. That's not adequate for the largest laden vessels in the Atlantic Ocean today, says Paul Bingham, director of transportation consulting at IHS Market in Los Angeles. By comparison, the port of Charleston, South Carolina, is being dredged to up to 54 feet. Norfolk, Virginia, is at 55 feet and looking to go deeper. Savannah is at 47 feet, Bingham says. When a massive container ship named the President Theodore Roosevelt cleared the Panama Canal with 14,800 TEUs in 2017, it called on Savannah, Charleston, and Norfolk. Charleston is undergoing a $1.3 billion capital plan that includes adding 12 more huge cranes to the 8 larger cranes and 9 smaller cranes it already has. Wilmington's turning basis is also an issue because it can't handle a 14,000 TEU ship. A plan to widen the basin with some environmental conditions has been approved, and the $30 million project would dredge another 3 feet. The cost of dredging deeper can be staggering. Charleston's dredging project is costing $529 million, with $330 million coming from federal funds and $199 million from the South Carolina Ports Authority. But all this is because the simple truth is the size of ships continue to explode. The biggest ship now is more than 21,000 TEUs, and more such behemoths are on the way. In 2015, COSA outlined some of his hopes for North Carolina and its ports. He wanted the port to raise its share of South Atlantic container volume from 2.9% to 4.7%. There are a host of North Carolina-based companies that are using other ports around us, COSA told TBJ at the time. If you look at companies in a 250-mile circle around us, our share of that market is very low. But North Carolina's share of South Atlantic container volume has diminished to 2.38%, according to the American Association of Port Authorities, as ports such as Charleston and Savannah have exploded. Where North Carolina does excel is in how it turns around ships. To do that reliably without breaking it takes a lot of skill, Bingham says. Those union workers at the Port of Wilmington are very good at it. They are able to, as they say in the business, work the ships. Wilmington also stands out for handling the freight quickly, which means the ship can get back out to sea. The Port of Wilmington is known as a very efficiently operated port, Bingham says. COSA has noted that the port is only a part of the overall transportation system. In a lengthy interview last year with the PBS show Carolina Business Review, COSA noted, "Nothing starts or stops at our port. We are a conduit to that supply chain." That supply chain includes rail and highway systems, and North Carolina faces challenges there, according to an analysis by the Institute for Transportation Research and Education at NC State University in 2018. Neighboring ports benefit from better rail and highway connections, the report stated. Inadequate hinterland connectivity is a major factor limiting the geographical area that a port can serve. Given the inland connectivity, it's no surprise that Wilmington and Morehead City have a noticeably smaller economic impact than competing ports that are better supported. For example, Kimsey's noted that many ports are serviced by multiple rail lines, but that CSX is the only rail line into Wilmington. You can work around that, but it takes some pretty good effort to make that happen, he says. Bingham notes that there is potential growth the state can capture, but he also believes North Carolina's measured approach makes sense. Up to a point, there's some valid economic development, but to be too ambitious and say we're going to replace Savannah or Norfolk is not prudent, he says. Kimsey's echoes that point, noting that investment in the port system should match the state's advantages. You have to understand what the port's role is in the economy, he says. If you start there and think through that, you can be very successful. But if you invest in something you're not really suited to be, it's no good. That man who started all this, McLean, named his shipping container Sea Land, and by the 1960s, it was a world leader. During the Vietnam War, he convinced the Pentagon to build a facility that can handle containers near Saigon. That demonstrated how ships packed with containers could deftly get cargo to Asia and foreshadowed the globalization of commerce. When he sold Sea Land in 1969, he earned a whopping $160 million. In 1985, Forbes listed him as one of America's wealthiest men at $360 million. McLean died at his home in Manhattan's East Side in 2001. Forbes magazine called him one of the few men who changed the world. And the morning of his funeral, container ships around the world blew their whistles in his honor. He's buried in the quiet grounds of Maxton's Oak Grove Cemetery beneath the simple gravestone. About 14 miles away, trucks rumble along I-95, their bellies stuffed with cargo from ship-laden containers. It's a world McLean first envisioned as he stood by his truck in 1937, and a world where, for the most part, those trucks that do visit North Carolina are merely passing through. And as usual, following the reading of the cover story, we come to the article, Executive Voice. This week's Executive Voice belongs to Deb Boucher. Deb Boucher has spent years specializing in science and technology real estate, working with clients to navigate an increasingly complex and competitive market and find spaces with offerings they need at a value they can afford. Now, as an executive director at Cushman & Wakefield, Boucher is taking that focus to a new level with the formation of a team dedicated to meeting the needs of science and technology companies and organizations. A Cornell University graduate, Boucher arrived in the Triangle in 2006 and found work at what would ultimately become Cushman & Wakefield after a series of mergers and acquisitions. As her science and technology team begins to take shape, she discusses what it takes to succeed as a broker and the advantages of experience and specialty in an ever-changing industry. And as you know, the Executive Voice article is always a Q&A, so here are the questions and answers. What's the best way to describe what you do? Her answer, I'm a connector. I help science and technology users find real estate solutions. That's acquisition of buildings, manufacturing plants, laboratories, greenhouses, and even parking lots, as well as ways to dispose of excess real estate they no longer need that allow them to execute on their business objectives and company mission. So how did you get into this line of work? My academic training was a combination of design, environmental psychology, and business that prepared me to understand how the built environment impacts human behavior and to make design and operational recommendations to influence and optimize the value and utility of physical space. I plan to go into real estate consulting at a management consulting or design firm. As luck would have it, I started my career in commercial real estate doing design and construction consulting at a tenant rep brokerage firm, the Staubach Company. Though the specifics of my role have evolved over the last 17 years, I've remained at a brokerage firm and now focus my practice on working with clients in the science and technology fields who typically have complex real estate solutions, complex real estate situations. Science and Tech Real Estate Brokerage is a lot of fun because it combines highly database decision-making with master-level interpersonal communication and negotiation skills. The best brokers in the business are experts at both of these elements and blend them seamlessly. What do you need to be successful in this industry? Five things. One, excellent communication skills, written, verbal, and nonverbal. Two, a sense of urgency and natural ability to triage emergencies. Three, the ability to organize and manage multiple tasks. Four, the highest level of ethics and true commitment to always do the right thing. And five, an entrepreneurial mindset. As a contingent fee business, there's no guaranteed salary, and there's rarely someone telling you exactly what to do. So what's the project you're most proud of? I absolutely love what I do, but I am only one person. Over the past several years, I've been building a team dedicated to science and tech real estate. The most gratifying professional experience is to see my colleagues grow into the spotlight, to become experts in their own right, and have our collective strengths combine into something truly special. I'm also proud to be recognized within Cushman & Wakefield for my extensive mentoring efforts to help cultivate the next generation of commercial real estate professionals. And finally, what's the best advice you've received? The earliest advice I can remember receiving was from my parents, teaching me the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It is such a simple and universal concept that everyone can understand, and the foundation upon which my personal and professional success is built. Also on this week's real estate page comes a couple of short articles here, one under the heading of Hospitality, Triangle Hotel Market Among the Best in Nation. As the economy continues to boom across the triangle, area hotels are feeling the positive vibes. Local occupancy rates continue to rise with demand and growth in revenue per available room, that's called RevPAR, and it's among the fastest in the nation, according to a report on the second quarter of 2019 by CBRE. Meanwhile, growth is slowing across the country as a whole. CBRE found the Triangle has the third highest gains in RevPAR in the country, with 6.7% growth in the second quarter. That's behind Dayton, Ohio at 7.9% and Albuquerque, New Mexico at 14.3%. All three markets saw occupancy rates grow faster than average daily rate growth. Across the country, RevPAR grew just 1.1%. That represents a 3% drop from last year and the lowest rate since 2010. The Triangle has also seen over 6% growth in demand and over 4% growth in occupancy. Earlier this year, Raleigh-based Concord Hospitality CEO Mike LaPorte said the biggest challenge he sees facing the industry is rising labor costs and worker shortages. And under the heading of redevelopment comes the article, Owners Seek Rezoning for Hundreds of Residential Units. A nearly 60-acre development may soon be headed to Route 64 in East Raleigh as the property's owners request the city rezone the land for a higher density, higher quality development. Rogers Realty and Insurance Company has applied to rezone 56 acres on NC 64 to allow for a mixed-use development featuring up to 200,000 square feet of non-residential space and 600 residential units. The property, currently undeveloped, is situated at 5000 Raleigh Beach Road. The application states Rogers would see the property split into three parcels. Subdistrict A, the westernmost tract, would allow for a maximum of 120,000 square feet of non-residential space and 200 dwelling units. Subdistrict B, in the middle, would allow for up to 60,000 square feet of non-residential space and 400 residential units. And Subdistrict C, the eastern side, would allow for up to 40,000 square feet non-residential space and 50 residential units. Now we turn to this week's Viewpoint page, and the guest column this week is written by John Hood, who's chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. His article is entitled, For North Carolina, It's As Middle As It Gets. In the context of American politics, North Carolina is a middle state, which is not the same as saying North Carolinians are especially moderate. simply means that our Democratic and Republican coalitions are roughly the same size, making our elections highly competitive and difficult to predict. Consider stated party preference a better predictor than party registration. According to Gallup polling, about 41% of North Carolinians identify as Democrats or say they lean Democratic. About 42% identify with or lean toward the GOP. The remaining indicate no preference. Only six other states have partisan spreads of 0 to 1 point in either direction. Massachusetts is the most Democratic state with a net blue advantage of 29 points. Wyoming is the most Republican one at plus 34 points. Governing magazine approached the question from a different direction. Its analysts first estimated the partisan leanings of demographic groups in the electorate based on race or ethnicity, education, and location. Then it ranked the states according to their proportions of each electoral group. The states most primed to support Democrats by this estimate include New Jersey, California, and Hawaii. The most Republican, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Maine. North Carolina was smack dab in the middle at number 25. As for ideology, there are many different ways to classify people based not on their votes, but on their viewpoints. Some analysts ask a battery of questions on a wide range of issues and then look for clusters of respondents whose responses are similar. I'm a big fan of these kinds of voter typologies, but alas, they are not available for every state. Alternatively, we can look at how people classify themselves. In Gallup polling, 39% of North Carolinians say they are conservative. 33% label themselves moderate. 21% say liberal. The rest don't have a preference. Because we all hear and interpret these terms a bit differently, these self-classifications aren't always useful for explaining and predicting political behavior. Still, they allow for cross-state comparisons. North Carolina ranks 21st in the share saying they're conservatives, and 28th in the share saying they're liberal. Across most of these measures, our state occupies the middle position alongside a few other closely matched states, such as Florida, Iowa, Wisconsin, Georgia, and Arizona. These are the places that tend to produce the most competitive races for U.S. Senate and governor. They are in play during presidential campaigns. They often feature spirited contests for down-ballot races and split control of localities among Democratic-leaning major cities and Republican-leaning suburbs, small cities, and rural communities. But don't assume that these middle states have the least partisan electorates. That's not necessarily true. The share of true swing voters, those without strong ideological leanings or party preferences, is sometimes rather small in these places and has dropped dramatically from the glory days of the ticket splitters, who decades ago would vote in large numbers for, say, a Republican for president and a Democrat for governor. Here in North Carolina, we're certainly a middle state among the spectrum of American politics. But we rank 46th in the number of residents who describe themselves as moderate. And we aren't appreciably different from the nation in the share of poll respondents who identify with neither major party. After Republicans won control of the General Assembly in 2010 and a host of statewide offices in 2012, some GOP leaders and activists thought they had witnessed a lasting realignment. It proved ephemeral. After the Democratic Party won the governor's race and key Supreme Court races in 2016 and 2018, some of its leaders and activists jumped to the conclusion that the GOP had flamed out and the state was reverting to its Democratic past. There are no inexorable trends here. The two coalitions remain closely matched in North Carolina. Either can win big races in 2020, and both will play hard to win them. Now we come to the editor's notebook, and this week's editorial is entitled, Not Easy to Put Workers Before Shareholders. Under mounting pressure from the public and private sector about the income gap between a CEO and workers at companies, some 200 CEOs recently attested to a business roundtable communique that stated companies must go beyond protecting shareholder interests. The statement went on to say companies should invest in their employees, have an ethical relationship with suppliers, and take steps to protect the environment. Who would disagree with such a sentiment? Except that these are only words, and generally speaking, words are not taxed, and nor can they hold people legally accountable. In contrast, the actions parlayed by the CEOs reflect what really has been going on with some of the largest corporations on earth. Full disclosure, I use the products and services of several of these companies. So do many of our readers. I'm not going to boycott them, but I hope the workers of these companies hold the leadership and board accountable going forward. So let's quickly review what's happened in the past 12 to 18 months. He points out four things. One, the highest paid 100 CEOs make 254 times the salary of an employee receiving the median pay at a company. Two, share buybacks are expected to reach $1 trillion in 2019. Yes, $1 trillion, a 26% increase from the year before, which also registered historic buyback levels. Funding comes from the drawdown of cash and taking on debt and leverage. In fact, buybacks are now exceeding free cash flow. In contrast, capital expenditures have increased only 8% at U.S. companies, and research and development expenses have gone up 9%. Three, average gross debt has risen 8% at companies. That number is expected to increase as borrowing money gets cheaper as the Federal Reserve keeps cutting rates. Finally, four, the median American household's net worth grew to an inflation-adjusted 16%. That's $88,000 in 6 years, buoyed primarily by the richest Americans. These numbers have gone up in the past 2 years, but so has the wealth gap. For public firms, looking beyond its fiduciary duty of catering to shareholders could be tricky. It leaves them open to litigation, and companies get sued for much smaller disagreements nowadays. But a company's workers could force the company management to invest more in the company itself and its workers than buying back shares. What's happened in the past year is that companies have used the cash from the corporate tax savings to buy back shares and bump value on Wall Street. But now, with signs of global showdown, the free cash flow is not as robust as they were, and no one-time incentives are available to artificially boost balance sheets. So if the 200-plus CEOs really believe in what they signed, they need to act and show the American workers that they are equally important along with the shareholders. Words are easy. Actions are tough. Well, that music means that we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long till next time.